Hey everybody, it's JT. What is on your holiday meal shopping list? Well, I would suggest Painted Hills Natural Beef. It is some of the best beef in the world. And your friends and family will be thanking you for a long time if you serve Painted Hills Natural Beef for your holiday meals. And now you can buy it online just by going to PaintedHillsBeef.com. Use the code BBQNATION at checkout and save yourself 15% on your order. Give Painted Hills Natural Beef a place on your table this holiday season.
It's time for Barbecue Nation with JT. So fire up your grill, light the charcoal, and get your smoker cooking. Now, from the Turn It, Don't Burn It studios in Portland, here's JT.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Nation. That's the Barbecue Nation. I'm JT, high atop the radio world and the Turn It, Don't Burn It studios in Portland, Oregon. And we welcome all of our affiliates on the Barbecue Nation Sun and Vision radio networks down the line. This portion of Barbecue Nation is brought to you in part by Painted Hills Natural Beef from the heart of the Pacific Northwest. Beef you can feel good about. That's Painted Hills Natural Beef. Well, you see them on television, and if you're at all into outdoor cooking, barbecue, grilling, smoking, what have you, you probably know this name. We've got Stephen Reichlin with us today. Stephen has won 5 James Beards Awards, 3 Julia Childs Awards. He does Barbecue U on public television. He's just a busy guy. So let's welcome our friend Stephen Reichlin. Hey, Stephen.
Great to be with you. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Good. You and your family surviving all this shutdown and different things?
We are. You know, being a writer, I am basically home anyway. So it has not been too much of a hardship for us. And it has certainly given me a lot of occasion to fire up the grill.
There you go. Hey, I wanted to kind of start off with something a little historical perspective here for our listeners, because we've got several new affiliates since you've been on the show.
Congratulations.
Thank you. What prompted you to get into barbecue? I know that you actually went to school up here where I live in Oregon, but, you know, it was kind of a direct and indirect path, I think, for you.
Well, it was a very indirect path. I mean, when you get a degree in French literature and you write your thesis on a medieval French poet, the immediate connection with barbecue is not necessarily apparent. But in fact, it sort of did lead me to food writing. When I was at Reed College, I wrote my thesis on a medieval French poet named Christine de Pizan, who was Europe's first feminist. And while I was doing my research, I came across a medieval cookbook, and it just blew my mind. I mean, first of all, there were ingredients I'd never heard of, like galangal and cubebs. The fact that somebody physically hand-wrote a cookbook 700 years ago and that it was still around and inspired people. So that fired my imagination mightily. Now, there was a third connection that I didn't make at the time because I didn't know I would get into barbecue, but that is that everything was cooked over a wood fire in the Middle Ages, and I would only come to appreciate that much later. My career in barbecue, it was an idea that came to me like a thunderbolt. I remember where I was sitting, what I was wearing. It was 1994, and the realization was that grilling is the world's oldest and most universal cooking method, but everywhere it's done differently. So I thought, wouldn't it be cool to travel around the world, what I came to call Planet Barbecue, and write about how people grill in different cultures? That project became the Barbecue Bible, and then I was hooked. And once I'd written the Barbecue Bible, I realized that, you know, here was a subject that is so deep and so broad, and, you can go into the science of barbecue, you can go into the anthropology of barbecue. It's something that everybody likes to cook, the techniques, something you could do on television, something you could do with a website, you could make products. So that really kind of, I would say that one momentary flash of inspiration really set the course of my life for the next 30 years.
Isn't that interesting how that one little thought can just change your whole world, so to speak?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I'm always impressed and kind of curious about how people do that. And like you said, cooking over wood, you know, I don't think a lot of people until the last, maybe 25 years, and you were certainly at the forefront of this, thought about wood cooking, except when they said, well, my grandma used to cook on a wood stove, which my grandmother did, and they kept the fire going all day long. Excuse me. I think that we kind of went forward by going backwards a little bit historically to look at what worked and what didn't. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, absolutely. And, you know, this is the new technique that has only been used by human beings for about 1.8 million years, with a brief of exception of maybe 100 years of having gas stoves and electric stoves. But absolutely, this was it is the best way to cook, because, you know, charcoal gives you heat and gas gives you heat, but a different kind of heat. And adding wood chunks to a charcoal fire gives you smoke, but only wood delivers both heat and smoke.
Yes.
I've been doing, you know, if you've been following my Facebook feeds this last month, I've been doing a lot of grilling over wood.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's I think that's very cool. And I think it's a lot of fun because I do it myself. You've heard me tell this story, I think, Stephen, maybe one of the first times you're on the show. I bought an offset cooker. I paid $149 from it at probably like Home Depot or something like that 20 odd years ago. And I still have it because I still love using it, you know, looking a little raspy at times, but I still use it because I love the flavor and stuff that comes out of that cooker. I just really do.
Absolutely.
Most Americans, I mean, statistics tell me, and sales, which is how I kind of gauge this, that most people use gas grills because they're easiest for the most part.
Yeah, I think it's about 68% gas and the rest charcoal, and wood is a small proportion, but, you know, wood is definitely growing.
Yes. So in the wood category would come the pellet smokers. Are you fond of pellet smokers?
I think pellet smokers have their place. I kind of like to see the flame and play with the flame, so I'm kind of more likely to work over wood or charcoal. But, you know, when it comes to slow smokes, turkeys, pork shoulders, ribs, you know, pellet grills are definitely rising. By the way, if I can just mention a new book that came out, it's called Healthy Wood Pellet Grill and Smoker Cookbook by Nancy Loesky. And that Nancy Loesky is none other than my assistant of 20 years now, and she's finally written her own book. Just came out this week, so check it out. It's a wonderful book, beautiful photographs, great recipes, and we're really happy for Nancy and proud of her.
Is that through Workman also?
No, actually, that is published through, let me just take a look at who the publisher is here. It is, looks like it's Alpha Books.
Okay.
Which I believe is a division of Dorling Kindersley.
You'll have to tell Nancy she'll get an invite from me shortly to be on the show. I'd love to
talk
to her.
Oh, that would be great.
Yeah, it would be really good. So when people, you know, like you said, 68% of the people are using some form of gas, whether it's natural.
Right. And by the way, there's another statistic which I find even more interesting.
Sure.
And that is the number of people that own more than one grill. And that is has grown to about 32%, and it's rising. So that, you know, that's a big trend, too. We should not overlook that.
No, and I'm guilty of that. Much like you are, I have a number of them.
Of course.
And my wife said if I got one more on the back deck, then I was in trouble.
Right.
When people start, do you think it's best that they kind of start off something they're comfortable with? Meaning if they grew up using charcoal, a Weber kettle, stick with that? Or should they go to a Weber gas grill, so to speak? And I don't care about the brand name. I'm just using that as an example.
Well, you know, first of all, whatever gets you grilling is what you should use. And I'm not going to tell you to get a charcoal grill if if the idea of lighting charcoal is going to be off-putting.
Sure.
But I would say if you can learn to grill over a charcoal grill, you can grill over anything. Whereas if you learn to grill over a gas grill, you know, you may have a little bit of an adjustment with a charcoal grill. Charcoal grills are a little bit more versatile. But that being said, you know, Island gas grills, I use them for, I'd say 4 or 5 nights a week we use a gas grill. So whatever gets you grilling.
Yeah, I'm a bit the same way. We use gas. I also use my pellet grill a lot if I'm going to throw a butt on there or something. You know, Oregon, where I'm from, is kind of the home base of pellet smokers for a long time.
That's right. Traeger's, that's where it started, right?
That's where it started, about 12 miles from where I live. So they're kind of an icon around here. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back and talk more with Stephen Reichlin. First thing we're going to do is, if you have grills, we're going to tell you how to clean them a little bit. And then we're going to talk about grilling some perfect steaks and stuff right here on Barbecue Nation. Stephen and I will be back right after this. Hey everybody, it's JT, and this is a special version of Barbecue Nation. It is brought to you in part by Painted Hills Natural Beef. Beef you can be proud to serve your family and friends. That's Painted Hills Natural Beef.
Freeze frame!
Hey, welcome back to Barbecue Nation. I'm JT, and you're listening to us on the Sun and Vision Radio Network. We thank you for that. Welcome our new affiliate in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Hey, guys out there, KFAQ Talk News 1170, I believe that is. And we welcome you to our family, and thank you for sharing your time with us. We've got Stephen Reichlin with us. Stephen, if you don't know, has written, is it 31 books now, Stephen?
Number 32 just went to the publisher.
You know, I talk to you once or twice a year, and you always are telling me that. I just did another one. So, you know, that's always exciting. So one of the things you talked about on your website, and I was poking around before we did the show, and a lot of people who have grilled and barbecued and smoked and stuff, it's the time of year where you should be thinking about maybe cleaning your grills a little bit from the leftover residual. That's kind of a double entendre there from last year. So, real quickly, what's the best way for folks to take a look at their grill and assume that it needs some cleaning, and what to do?
First thing I would look at the grate. I mean, if it's disgusting, then you need to heat your grill as hot as it will go and take a stiff wire brush to it, get it cleaned off, and then oil it with a folded paper towel dipped in oil drawn across the bars of the grate. That is the easiest way to clean the grate. Next thing you want to do is look at your drip pan, and this is a big offender and actually a potential offender, but, you know, when you're grilling, if you're working on a gas grill, all the grease goes down to a little drip pan under the burner box. You want to empty that out. If you're working on a charcoal grill, that ash catcher fills up, and you want to empty that out. Then look under the hood, and you want to scrape. You get a lot of soot and ash under the hood. Sometimes that can flake off into your food, so you want to scrape that either with a stiff brush or a scraper. Clean that. Those are the big three. In fact, our blog on Barbecue Bible last week was a blog about getting your grill cleaned for the season. Of course, probably most of your listeners, like me, grill all year round.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah, no, it's good. I find that cleaning them kind of, for me, it's almost a regular schedule because I use them so much that.
Well, the other thing is, remember, you know, a lot of people do that, keep it hot, keep it clean, keep it lubricated, you know, my little three-step mantra when starting to grill. But do remember that you should also clean your grill after you're done with your grill session.
Right.
Leaving that salmon skin kind of burnt on for the next week does not add flavor. It's just disgusting. Of course, in general, if your wife tells you it's disgusting, it probably is.
It is. And when you open the lid and you haven't looked at it over the course of the winter, and you open the lid and there's creatures in there or little biological experiments, probably a good hint to get that thing cleaned. Okay, I want to talk about something. Here's something that most everybody grills, steaks. And, of course, now there's the Steak Cook-Off Association. They're cooking on chimneys. They're doing all kinds of fun stuff. But the average person at home probably is not going to do that. So what is the difference if you're doing charcoal versus you know, stick wood or gas like that, give us kind of the variables that you have to deal with when you're cooking that, and what's the best way in Stephen Reichlin's entourage and your repertoire for cooking like a good 2-inch or better ribeye.
Well, okay, so the first thing, it's much less a function of what kind of grill or fuel you're using and much more a function of what steak you're cooking. Is it an intrinsically tender cut like a New York strip or a ribeye? Is it a tougher steak like a flank or a skirt? And how big is it? Now, if you're cooking a 2-inch steak, what I like to do is I set up my grill. I've got a hot zone, and then I've got a medium zone. And I do a quick sear on both sides over the hot zone, then slide the steak over to the cooler zone and slowly cook it. And sometimes I'll even have the cooler zone off and lower the grill lid, so you're doing a hot sear and then kind of an indirect grill. That is the opposite of another technique that's called the reverse sear, where you basically indirect grill your steak to bring it up to about 100 degrees and then flash grill it right at the end. But with a big, thick steak, those are the techniques you want to use. With a thin steak, on the other hand, you want to work over a very high heat and you want to grill very quickly. So you leave the center nice and bare.
When do you like to pull them off? 125, 130? What's Stephen Reichlin's preferred
temp? Yeah, I'm a medium rare kind of guy. I go to about 135. Might pull it at 133 and let it nudge up. Up a few degrees.
I'm kind of with you on that. I like it pink, but I don't want it still being able to run away off the plate. Mm-hmm. You know, that's kind of my thing. When people are cooking steaks like that, Stephen, and then like you made a comment when we were talking about the cleaning aspect, you all of a sudden you get a notion that you are going to do a salmon fillet. So there are two different species, two different types of proteins there, basically. So give us some advice on cooking a nice salmon fillet.
Well, first of all, if you have the choice to get either a fillet or a steak, I would take a salmon steak because I think with the bones in the salmon steak, you get a little more flavor, and it's a little easier to hold together on the grill. Cooking a fillet, often it sticks to the grill grate.
Right.
One trick is you put it on the you oil the grate really well. You start with a hot grate. You brush the fish with oil too. When it goes on the grate, do not try and move it or turn it instantly. Most people, they'll put the fish fillet on the grill and then 20 seconds later and try and move it. Let it grill for a good minute and a half to 2 minutes. That will give the meat a chance to stick and then come back up. If you try and move it too quickly, it will stick. But when I'm cooking a salmon fillet, I often like to do it on a cedar plank. I char the cedar plank first. That keeps the fish moist. It keeps it from sticking. It looks great. You get some extra flavor from the cedar. You know, pretty great way to work all the way around.
Oh yeah, they coming from my neck of the woods. We've got an abundance of cedar planks up here.
Of course you do. Yeah.
That's great. Do you know who actually came up with that? That's a question because I don't know.
Well, put it this way, it is very ancient. I suspect it was being practiced before the white man came to the American continent.
Stephen Reichlin is author, television host, blogger, writer, world traveler. He's a lot of things, and he's a friend of the show, and he and I are going to be back in just a minute here on Barbecue Nation. Please stay with us. Hey, everybody, it's JT, and this is a special version of Barbecue Nation. It is brought to you in part by Painted Hills Natural Beef. Beef you can be proud to serve your family and friends. That's Painted Hills Natural Beef. Welcome back to Barbecue Nation. I'm JT. Today we're talking with Stephen Reichlin. Also like to thank the folks at Painted Hills Natural Beef for being part of this show. From the heart of the Pacific Northwest comes a beef product you can be proud of and feel very good about to serve your family and friends. That's Painted Hills Natural Beef. If you'd like to send us an email real quick, it's barbecue, that's BBQ, at salempdx.com. And also you can find the shows, our complete archive of shows, anywhere from SoundCloud to Captivate to Apple Podcasts to all of them. I think we're on 14 different platforms out there now. So there's a lot of them. Not too hard to find. Just look up Barbecue Nation. That's BBQ Nation with JT. And it'll be right there. And we will be right there. So we're talking with Stephen Reichlin today from Barbecue University. And Stephen, was your first work Barbecue Bible? I mean,
no, actually, my first book was a book called A Taste of the Mountains Cooking School Cookbook. It was a cooking school that I ran in the White Mountains of New Hampshire many, many years ago. And it was really a French-oriented book. You know, I got my start in cooking in Paris. I went to cooking school in Paris after Reed College in Portland, Oregon. And so my first, I'd say my first 5 years in the food scene, I was very French-oriented.
I like it. I like it. I happen to have an affinity for French food, but I'm not. And if you looked at me, you would know why. The Ten Commandments of Smoking that you put on your site and in your books, give us some of those for our new listeners.
Well, let's see. You know, one of them, the mantra, it's keep it hot, keep it clean, keep it lubricated. You know, that start with a hot grill grate, clean it with a stiff wire brush or wooden scraper, and lubricate or oil it either with a chunk of steak or bacon fat held at the end of your tongs. Or with a folded paper towel dipped in oil and drawn across the bars of the grate. Oiling does three things. It keeps food from sticking. It helps give you killer grill marks. It also cleans the grill grate. And, you know, there have been a small number, but a documented number of cases where grill bristles have fallen out of the brush and wound up in your food. By cleaning the grate this way with the folded paper towel, you know, that guarantees that nothing you don't want to be in your food will be in your food.
Sure.
So that was one. Let's see. There's turn, don't stab. You know, use tongs for turning the food. Give it a rest when you're grilling meats. You know, you don't want to serve hot off the grill. You always want to rest a steak or a chop or chicken breast for a few minutes before you serve it. And I like to actually set up a wire rack over a sheet pan and rest the steak on that so the air can kind of flow underneath of it as well as on top of it. So when you're resting, you're not causing the bottom to get soggy.
There you go. Now, here's a problem. I'm sorry, my allergies are just kicking my rear up here. And you lived up here, so you're probably aware of that. Ways to control the heat when you're using charcoal. I think that may be flubs up people more than anything when they're using charcoal. They get the fire really, really hot, and then it kind of burns out quick. They don't have a cool side to the grill. Give us your ideas and your thoughts on how people can control their heat better and make it more even for them.
Very simple. Very simple. So you build what's called a tiered fire or a three-zone fire, and that is you mound your coals more thickly at the back, spreading them out into single layer in the center, and the front third of the grill has no coals whatsoever. That's your fire-free or safety zone. And the way you control the heat is you move it closer to the hot zone to sear, over the middle zone to cook, and then over the safety zone if you want to just warm it or it starts to burn or you get flare-ups, so you can dodge the flare-ups.
That's very good advice. I wish some of my friends would adhere to that when they're cooking, because you've seen it like I have. They too hot in one area and it's right square in the middle. That's kind of a pun because square in the middle of a round grill. Anyway, they get it too hot and, you know, it's very hard because when you've got that big pile in the middle, it kind of is too hot, and then all of a sudden it's kind of too cold, and they're fussing around trying to either add more charcoal or rake it out or something, and I like your idea there. You talk a lot about, in all your writings, direct versus indirect and the outcomes of that. So is it more important to do on thicker pieces of meat to, and it doesn't matter whether it's chicken or beef or whatever, is it more important to do more indirect and then just finish it off on the direct heat, or vice versa?
Well, let's define a couple terms first. So direct grilling, you use that for steaks, chops, fish fillets, anything that cooks quickly, you know, that's tender and cooks quickly. Indirect grilling, you're cooking next to, not directly over the fire. So on a charcoal grill, you'd rake the coals to the sides and cook in the center. On a gas grill, you'd light the front and rear or outside burners and do your cooking in the center, always with the lid closed. The way to think of it is sort of the difference between on your stove when you're cooking directly over a gas burner that's a high heat as opposed to roasting in the oven. Now, indirect grilling can be a great friend. I mean, you use it for a whole chicken. You use it for a pork shoulder. I like to indirect grill chicken legs, chicken thighs, because the skin gets really crisp. And anytime you want to grill something and you don't want to kind of worry about burning it, indirect grill it. However, you cannot indirect grill a steak. There are some foods that only taste good if they're direct grilled. You might indirect grill a whole fish, but you would definitely direct grill a fish fillet.
Sure. Now, do you actually use the, let's talk about a gas grill for a second. Most of them have at least one upper rack. Some of them have two. I'll tell you, I like to do, you were talking about chicken, especially doing like chicken legs and chicken thighs. I like to actually pull them off the regular grill grate and put them up there sometimes, especially if I'm cooking for a large crowd. Do you do that, or how do you manage that?
Well, I have to confess that whenever I get a new gas grill, the first thing I do is I take out and throw away the upper grill grate.
Okay.
But maybe I should, because it's a good, it's good for warming.
Yeah. It's just, when I'm doing large groups, tailgaters, whatever, it seems to be a nice kind of reservoir to keep them up there for me. One of the things that we didn't talk about, and we've got about 3 minutes left in this segment, and you write about 6 key temperatures before you grill. What are those, and what should people know about those?
Well, these are basically the internal temperatures, and much as it, when you watch me grill on Project Fire or Project Smoke, very often I'll use the poke test, and I'll sort of squeeze with my fingers or poke with my fingers. But the only real way to know that you're hitting the exact temperature you want is to use an instant read meat thermometer. So let's see, what are the temperatures? Maybe 120 to 125 would be a rare steak. 135 would be a medium steak. 145 would be about medium. 160 is the safe temperature for sausage. 165 is the safe temperature for chicken and other poultry, although, in fact, I cook chicken more like to 170, 175. I find it's a little more tender and just delicious when it's cooked a little bit more. And then we jump up to 205 degrees, which is the temperature to which you want to cook brisket in order to get it properly tender.
Right. What do you do for like large birds, like turkeys? Do you spatchcock them, or do you just cook them?
No, I always feel like that looks like a bird that had an accident. I like the Norman Rockwell-esque beauty of a whole plump smoked bird.
I'm with you on that. Chickens, I don't mind doing the spatchcock thing on, because...
No, chicken is fine, but spatchcock a turkey, it just looks like it had an accident.
Roadkill for Norman. I guess that would be one way to do it. Before we take a break, we've got one more real short segment after this, Stephen. But what's your favorite beef cut to grill or smoke or whatever you want to do with it?
I love a porterhouse. Just something about a porterhouse. It's two steaks. It's a filet mignon, and it's a New York strip connected by a T-shaped bone. It's a big, thick steak. It's impressive to look at. Italians call it bistec alla Fiorentina. Texans call it, Texas T-bone. I think that's probably my favorite cut.
I'm with you on that. I love it. Stephen and I are going to take a break, and we're going to be back in just a couple minutes here on Barbecue Nation. Please stay with us. And you're listening to us on the Sun and Vision Radio Networks. Oh, Hey, everybody, it's JT, and this is a special version of Barbecue Nation. It is brought to you in part by Painted Hills Natural Beef. Beef you can be proud to serve your family and friends. That's Painted Hills Natural Beef. Hey, everybody, welcome back to Barbecue Nation. I'm JT. Today we're talking with Stephen Reichlin. Do you ever think you're going to run out of stuff to write about?
Hasn't happened yet. If I ever run out of things to write about barbecue, there's always fiction. You know, I wrote a novel a few years ago. That was a wonderful experience, and I'm itching to do it again.
There you go. When the Reichlin family sits down for dinner, what would be a normal meal for the Reichlin family?
Well, you know, unfortunately, Reichlin family has not been having a lot of get-togethers since we've all been instituted stay at home.
Right.
But brisket is a perennial favorite. Those big monster beef ribs that are bigger than the kids in the family, those are perennial favorites. Steak is a big favorite at the house. When we can get them, Florida lobster tails, we love to do those. There are always a lot of vegetables. There's often a grilled dessert. So it's very eclectic.
I like it. Now, do you use any rules? Like at my house, we do a protein, and then I have three vegetables or two vegetables and a fruit when I serve a plate. Do you concoct anything like that?
We do not have a lot of rules at our household. we're pretty freewheeling. But I would say that very often we wind up doing that just by dint of the way we like to eat and the kinds of foods we like to eat.
How easy is it, Stephen, for people to overcook vegetables? Let me give you an example. Asparagus on the grill. I love asparagus when it's done properly. But I've seen people that have, where it's barely touched the grill. And then I've seen people where it's not very appetizing. Because it's way overcooked.
You know, my kind of rule of thumb for grilling that way is if it's brown is good, black is bad. So if something is nicely browned, even darkly browned, even very darkly browned, it's likely delicious. But the moment it becomes jet black, it's likely not delicious.
There you go. Now, I want to jump back one subject matter real quick. You talked about brisket. We didn't really touch on that on this show this time, but brisket seems to be the holy grail of barbecue, especially to competitors. And, if brisket is that, the weekend warrior sometimes can be intimidated by brisket. So very quickly, do you suggest if somebody's trying a brisket for the first time to do the whole brisket or just do the flat? And what should they look for?
It's actually easier to cook a whole brisket than a flat because a whole brisket has a lot more fat in it, so it's less likely to dry out. However, you know, a 16-pound of hunk of meat, it can be intimidating if you're doing it the first time. If you do a brisket flat, if you look in my book, The Brisket Chronicles,
right,
or even back in Barbecue Bible, I have a technique. I call it bacon smoked brisket flat, where you cook the brisket flat in a foil pan and you drape the top with bacon, so the melting fat keeps the flat moist. And that's a pretty effective way to cook a flat. Flat, you know, I wouldn't do anything less than 3 pounds, but between 3 and 6 pounds, it's a nice hunk of meat. It's manageable. You can kind of get away with cooking it in maybe 6 to 7 hours as opposed to 10 to 12 hours.
Do you wrap at all, Stephen?
I do wrap. Well, not with that foil method. I do not wrap with the foil method. But when I'm cooking a full packer brisket, I do wrap in butcher paper about 2/3, 3/4 of the way through.
Waxed or not waxed?
Not waxed. Silicone. But, you know, just butcher paper.
Yeah, okay. I just got another roll of the pink paper at my front door yesterday. So that's why I had to ask. You know, it's like that. If you had two things very quickly for somebody that's just listening to this show for the first time, they've got an interest in, let's just say grilling, not so much barbecue and smoking. They're just getting started. What are two things that you can recommend to them and say, pay attention, and if you do this, you get off to a good start?
Well, I mean, first of all, I'd say go to barbecuebible.com, which is my website, and there's lots of information on grilling and barbecuing in that. Or pick up a copy of one of my books like Project Fire or Barbecue Bible, where, again, those are just devoted to grilling. But the second thing, I mean, you know, it's just you have to learn to control the fire. Don't have it control you. And if you're the kind of griller who builds a roaring fire, throws the food on, and then somehow prays it will come out cooked and not burnt, that's not how you do it.
Very quickly, Stephen, you also have sauces and other companies, some products. How can people find those from you?
So on barbecuebible.com, that's BARBECUEBIBLE.com, you can find the full full series of my Project Smoke barbecue rubs and Project Smoke barbecue sauces.
Excellent.
Just click on store or just search for Stephen Reichlin sauces.
There you go. Stephen, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show, and we'll have you back hopefully before your next book comes out. How's that?
Well, that would be nice. The pleasure is mine. You always do such a good job. Thank you.
Thank you. Folks, we'll be back. And for those of you who get the second hour of the show, stay with us. And until then, remember our motto here, turn it, don't burn it. For everybody here, thank you for listening. Take care.
Barbecue Nation is produced by JTSD LLC Productions in association with Envision Networks and Salem Media Group. All rights reserved.